From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
It is really so important for people around the country in other cities, urban cities, small cities, to watch what's happening in Detroit, because whatever good, whatever we finally get to that is the thing, is going to be a pilot for how to fix cities across the country. That there will be things that will be tried here and will come here, and it's not going to happen right away. You're going to have to get rid of some people and change some mindsets. But when it does come, what does work here and works really well will work in other places. So I'm hoping that people, instead of making the jokes about Detroit, you know, Armageddon or Detroit, I guess I'll take Armageddon. You know, no, don't do that. Detroit is not dead. Stop trying to bury Detroit. Detroit is just going through the throes of an urban city. But there's hope living there, and hope springs eternal.
Rochelle Riley, columnist at the Detroit Free Press. The Detroit riot of 1967 began when police vice squad officers executed a raid in the early morning hours of July 23, 1967, on an after-hour blind pig located at the corner of 12th Street and Claremont. They were expecting to round up a few patrons, but instead found 82 people inside holding a party for two returning Vietnam veterans and one who was on his way over. By the time the smoke cleared almost a week later, 2,000 buildings across the city had been looted, damaged, or destroyed, and tanks had rolled through the streets. 42 people lay dead, 1,189 injured, and over 7,200 Detroiters had been arrested. The origins of the urban unrest in the Motor City were rooted in a multitude of political, economic, and social factors, including police abuse, lack of affordable housing, urban renewal projects, economic inequality, and rapid demographic change. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Detroit, 50 years after the 1967 riot, with Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley, In Black America.
The riots defined the city for a long time. Okay. The social conditions that were going on in 1967, some of those are prevalent now. There's crime like you wouldn't believe. There's a sense of hopelessness among a lot of folks in the city. But there is also an amazing amount of work and progress and construction that's being done. And I think the biggest thing is people just need to get out of their own way. That attitude of less self-worth is slowly getting peeled back, and that's the most exciting thing coming out of Detroit. You know, people always talk about the scale of the riot, you know, because everybody was having riots. You know, there were riots in Watts, riots in New York. The riots in Detroit were worse regardless of what people say, because, you know, when you read the history, they say, well, the New York City draft riots were worse. No, they weren't, because that was a New York City riot. Watts was a neighborhood. You know, Detroit was, you know, a city where you could see that the tide was turning as far as culture and race were concerned. And it was the beginning of Detroit becoming a majority black city.
Sunday, July 23rd, 1967 was like any other Sunday for my brother and me. We would visit our cousins who had lived on West Philadelphia and our grandparents who lived at the southwest corner of 12th Street in Claremont. As we exited the large freeway, Claremont was blocked off. This was not unusual. Therefore, we took another route. Upon arriving at our cousin's house, we were informed that a riot was going on 12th Street. Smoke was visible as we directed ourselves to our destination. We thought nothing of it. Come to find out, earlier that morning, the Detroit Police Department had raided a blind pig located at the corner of 12th Street and Claremont. Two undercover officers had been there 5 hours earlier, but didn't get in because the doorman was suspicious. Now here's where the two different stories of how the unrest started. The news version has it, as the police waited for additional paddy wagons, a crowd of 200 gathered. Bricks and balls were thrown at the officers waiting. Word on the street has it, as the officers were taking their prisoners down the stairs, one of the officers kicked a female prisoner down the stairs, and the rebellion was on. We spoke with columnist Rochelle Riley in 2012 and again this year regarding how the events shaped the city and how the city has moved on 50 years later.
Well, you know, I can tell you that there is hope in Detroit, and people try to bury Detroit every year, and Detroit refuses to get in the casket. And I think at some point, folks need to stop. The riots defined the city for a long time. Okay. The social conditions that were going on in 1967, some of those are prevalent now. There's crime like you wouldn't believe. There's sense of hopelessness among a lot of folks in the city, but there is also an amazing amount of work and progress and construction that's being done. And I think the biggest thing is people just need to get out of their own way. That attitude of less self-worth is slowly getting peeled back, and that's the most exciting thing coming out of Detroit. You know, people always talk about the scale of the riot, you know, because everybody was having riots. You know, there were riots in Watts, riots in New York. The riots in Detroit were worse regardless of what people say, because when you read the history, they say, well, the New York City draft riots were worse. No, they weren't, because that was a New York City riot. Watts was a neighborhood. You know, Detroit was a city where you could see that the tide was turning as far as culture and race were concerned, and it was the beginning of Detroit becoming a majority black city. And it destroyed the heart of the city. The heart didn't stop beating, but it was torn. And people have spent years trying to put it back together without being serious about it. You can't put your heart back together and still not like each other. You can't put your heart back together and not work together. And for the first time in the history that I've read and in the history that I've seen for this past decade, people are finally getting, well, you know what, we're not going to kill each other. We better work together. So you've got corporations that are moving their headquarters to the center of the city. You've got people moving in from the suburbs, particularly young people and people of all colors, moving back to the city. So it's going to take some time, but it has already started.
You mentioned earlier about the population in Detroit. Is it on a decline or is it leveling out?
No, it's going to get lower. You know, this is a city that almost hit 2 million people at its peak.
Right.
And was like just one of the industrial hubs. And, you know, you go to Detroit, it was like going to New York. And it's going to continue to decline as people leave who can't afford to. You know, a lot of the people who are in Detroit can't afford to move. There are plenty of people who can afford to be there but are trying to make decisions, you know, for their families about whether they should continue to stay. The schools are still in flux. They were in great disarray. I think the saddest thing is Michigan is one of those states because of the auto industry. The auto industry has been one of the great industrial blessings of the 20th and 21st centuries, but it's also been one of those things that masks a problem. Because you could have a great middle class living, you know, working in the auto plants, you didn't really have to be, you know, overly educated. I mean, that's just the way it was. You didn't need a college degree. You didn't need a master's. And people did that. You know, they had two cars in the driveway, a house in Detroit, and a cottage up in northern Michigan. Well, with the advent of computers and computerized automotive design and the streamlining of the plants, that's no longer true.
You mentioned earlier the population shift and those moving to the suburb, but it's not only white flight, it's African-American flight, because a lot of my classmate I grew up with now live in the suburb. How is that affecting the tax base in Detroit and the value of real estate?
Well, see, it's almost a misnomer. I mean, we've been talking about white flight for years. It started out as white flight, but it has always been economic flight.
Yes.
It was green flight.
Right.
There are plenty of black folks who have been in the suburbs for 40 years.
Exactly.
The people who could afford to move, moved. And what you saw is that the as often as things got better for people of color, whether they're black or Hispanic or in our, you know, neighborhoods, Chinese or Arabic, you know, they would live elsewhere. So all of a sudden, you know, you saw this sort of change, this demographic change, where Southfield, which is just north of Detroit and was one of the new, you know, suburbs that all, you know, the folks moved to who could afford to, and most of them were white. Well, then a whole lot of black folks who could afford to started moving there.
Exactly.
So the white folks moved again. So all of a sudden now you've got Southfield being predominantly black. But that is what it is. It's economic flight. But the sad thing for Detroit and the greatest challenge it will have is, again, a lot of the people who are left are not contributing to the tax base.
Going back to Coleman Young, his legacy in Detroit in bringing Detroit forward.
Well, you know, you will hear people talk about Coleman Young, you know, in divergent terms. You know, he was the most beloved man. He was the most hated man. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
Time, right.
What people don't understand is, you know, when you're dealing with discrimination, years of discrimination, and you finally have somebody who looks like you, who is elected, who is going to change the way things are done. I mean, he's a Tuskegee Airman and labor leader who came in and said, you know what, we're not going to have a city hall where black people can't work. We're not going to have a police department, you know, where we think that, you know, you've got units who are out hurting black people more than helping them. And he integrated the Detroit Police Department, and the percentage of black police officers rose from 19% to 63%. Well, that's not unusual if your city population is going from 19% black to 87% black. Why should that be a surprise? But, you know, he won overwhelmingly because black folks had a leader who listened to them and who, you know, wanted to make sure that Detroit got to do things that they participated in. So many of the things that exist in Detroit now happened under his administration, the
right.
completion of the GM Renaissance Center, which wasn't owned by General Motors then, the Joe Louis Arena, all these landmarks. And he helped GM to come down and put their pole town plant in the city.
Kwame Kilpatrick, rising son and now, I guess, a disgrace to the city and what he could have done and what he could have become. How has that affected the city and I guess the young population, because I would assume that he was a role model?
Well, this city was devastated by the downfall of Mayor Kilpatrick. The sad thing is, and I have said this and I've written this in my column, he was someone who could have been Barack Obama before Barack Obama was Barack Obama. He was the scion of this political family, the son of Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick, longtime
right.
congresswoman who, it is said, you know, lost her career because of what happened with him. He had the potential to do so much, but the things that the demons that sort of dealt that he dealt with, I think, were things that were under the surface, you know, for some time. There's you know, all types of conversations about when did he start to make the decisions that he made, and nobody really knows. I think the greatest loss is what he could have been potentially
right.
for Detroit. That's the saddest part. And there's always fights here because, you know, Detroit is one of the last cities that sees itself as we have to hold on to black leadership
right.
because it's not going to happen anyplace else. We have to have black mayors. And what I have said, and I've survived, nobody's burned my house down, is that being black should not be the first requirement for your mayor or any leader.
Exactly.
Now, when you've got strong, very talented, very smart black people who are running for mayor, absolutely. But that should not be the first or the only requirement. So, and we'll see how that plays out because there is an executive who's a former public official who is circling,
right.
you know, circling his hat. He hasn't thrown it into the ring. He's walking around it like, you know, when we used to play musical chairs. At some point, he'll pick it up and throw it in there. And so, of course, the first question people ask is, will Detroit elect a black mayor? Which is racist on his face because this is not the Detroit of 1967. And when you had TV reporters going out and putting mics in front of people's faces saying, well, would you vote for a white person to be mayor? And they looked at him, we'll vote for anybody who can fix this stuff. We don't have street lights that work. The
exactly.
buses don't run on time. We're about to run out of money. Stop talking to us about, you know, color. We want somebody to fix the problems. Now, of course, there are people who said, absolutely not.
Exactly.
And if the whole city shut down, they're fine. We had one crazy guy to stand up at a public meeting, which meant it was all over TV, that said, we'll burn the city down before we'll have somebody, you know, white. And we said, we need somebody to go and get him and help him move to Canada.
In case you're just joining us, you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. We're speaking with Rochelle Riley, a columnist with the Detroit Free Press. Rochelle, did you have an opportunity to talk to Dave Bean considering how the city was in peril when he decided, one, to take up the mantle to become mayor, but understanding he was coming on the heels of Kwame Kilpatrick and understanding, I would assume, an intelligent man as he is, he had done his homework, and Detroit was facing some very serious problems immediately once he came into office.
Well, I not only talked to him about it and wrote about it, but I'm one of the people who encouraged him to run, and I had the honor of being the one to announce it before
okay.
he told anyone else, before he had any press conference, and before he, you know, stood before people to declare his intent. And part of that was we needed an honest man. We needed somebody with some honesty and integrity and respect to come in and try to get people to understand that what has happened in Detroit, what happened in Detroit from 2006 to 2009 is not Detroit. And you can do business here and you can raise families here. And don't look at any one instance of something happening in Detroit and thinking that represents the city and everybody in it. And it was so important for somebody honest, you know, a good man to step up and do that. So, yes, we talked about it often. As a matter of fact, we'd have lunch, and I'd say, when are you going to run for mayor? And he'd laugh, and I said, I'm not laughing. And and I'll never forget, we were having dinner, and he does this sometimes with some journalists, but we had dinner simply because it was dinner time, and his wife doesn't mind because I know her. And I said, okay, are you going to run? And he said, you know, I am going to consider a run. Now, not I'm going to run, I'm going to consider. The paper splashed it across the top of the front page. There was such excitement. And once he saw that excitement and realized that, yes, this can work, he did it. And I can tell you, the job has almost killed him. He took on something that I'm sure he had no idea how bad it was. He knew the damage that had been done by the previous mayor, and he knew there were financial problems, and he knew that there was a lot to do. I will never believe that anybody can truly understand how bad things are until they're sitting in there and they hand them all the books, which, by the way, are all in pen and paper. You know, there's very little that's computerized.
Well, Cheryl, we spoke maybe 5 years ago about Detroit in the 1967 riot. So upcoming is the 50th anniversary of the civil disobedience, civil revolt, riot, or whatever you want to call it. How is Detroit doing 50 years later?
Well, it would be impossible to not admit that Detroit has changed and gotten better, because it's 50 years and it's a different city. And in the past 3 to 5 years, it's been amazing. The renaissance has happened at the city's core in the 7.2 square miles of downtown from the Detroit River north. But out in the neighborhoods, people are having some of the same problems they had 50 years ago. And I have people to tell me on a regular basis that, you know, we're just 2 or 3 instances or maybe another year of poverty away from a 67 happening again.
And when you look back, when you first came to Detroit, I think in 2000, were there any preconceived notions about the city once you arrived there?
Well, I had my own preconceived notions. When they tried to hire me, I wasn't going to come. I said, Detroit, you know, the only things I knew about Detroit were what I saw on television, that it was a burned out city and that people were very sad and underpaid and not working hard enough, not enough jobs. I came for the first visit, and yes, there were still a lot of boarded up buildings, and there was no national chain grocery store. There was no movie theater. I almost would move to a city that doesn't have a movie theater. it was the Detroit that people knew. But underneath that, there was still, this is what you don't know when you're visiting Detroit or you don't live here. Mm. There is this resilient, defiant spirit among the people here that is like a never say die. That is just amazing. I mean, everybody here is a ride or die chick or a ride or die brother. And to live here and to experience that is something special. I came here intending to stay for 2 years. I was on my way to L.A. in 2002. I've now been here 17 years, so that tells you something about how this city gets into your blood and gets into your DNA, and you want to be a part of making it better. And the Detroit that exists now is beyond anything I could have dreamed.
When you look at some of the problems that Detroit was facing back in the late 60s, some of it had to do with African-American clout. Has that changed any significantly since that time?
The biggest change in particular is that you've got a Detroit City Council. There are 9 members. 8 of them are black.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't have happened 50 years ago. It has its first Hispanic member, because that whole area of Detroit that they call, and mind you, I'm not making this up, they call it Mexican Town, and it is where most of the Mexican and Hispanic and Cuban and Puerto Rican, all the different types of Latino populations live. And it is this amazing place with a great culture and restaurants and spirit and pride in self. You can't do that everywhere. I mean, there are some cities who do it with Chinatown, but, you know, I've not seen that someplace else in this way. And yet this is the first time they've had a member of any Hispanic group on the city council in history. So, yeah, there are changes, and it is different. But and there have also, of course, been a series of black mayors who have had varying degrees of success and total failure. But you don't have a waiting list of people to move into those leadership positions, and you don't have people who are CEOs of the top companies who are people of color. And you, quite frankly, still don't have enough people who are able to take on some of the good jobs, and you don't have enough of the jobs that people can take for the people who can do them. So our unemployment rate is still higher than it should be, and the school system is still undergoing construction, not physical construction, but, you know, emotional and academic construction. And that should not be something that takes 10, 20, 30 years when you're graduating kids every year and bringing in kids every year, and you still have kids who score at the lowest levels on reading and math of kids across the country on national accepted tests.
Another problem was the police department, but when you consider the department was almost 90%+ white in 67, any improvement from then will be an improvement.
And it was an improvement. When you're that low, the only place you can go is up. There's a black police chief who literally grew up here as a kid. He watched his dad, who was a cop. He's mm-hmm. now the chief. And you know what we don't have here? We don't have the situations, let me knock some wood or hit myself in the head, where we have to tell people that Black Lives Matter.
Okay.
You know, we have not had that kind of tension. Now, we have plenty of tension. You know, we've got gangs, we've got crime, we've got neighborhoods where people aren't safe, but we don't have that going on, and a lot of that is due to this community policing that the chief is doing, and, you know, a lot of this comes from him. But when you do talk to people, they talk about how it's a little better in a lot of neighborhoods, and they do turn people in, and they do have conversations about making it safer. But there's still places in the city where, you know, you don't go. I had somebody to rear end me in a neighborhood, and I called the city desk, and I said, hey, I'm at this intersection, and I just got rear-ended. And my editor told me, go home and call the police and tell them where you were hit.
When we last spoke, you talked about the employment or lack thereof in Detroit. Back in the 60s, one could have a factory job with little education, high school diploma, and still have a decent living. Now, most of the factories are computerized, so that creates a problem without someone having a degree. Is that still a concern or still a problem that's affecting some of the citizens in Detroit?
It's one of the biggest concerns because you have an industry that has sort of dictated Michigan's economy and what happens with Michigan's roads, what happens with the lack of transportation systems. Everything is about cars. And when people could work on the line, you know, they had a very good living. And when I say very good living, I mean upper middle class. They got a house. They got a cottage up north, two cars in the driveway. And some of these are people who could not do any other job. When I first started covering the problem with functional adult literacy in Detroit 16 years ago, I had people to call me and ask me not to write about it. And I said, why? I thought they were worried that I might be doing something wrong. They said, no, we don't want people to know. They knew that that was the case, and that reading problem is a problem for training, because for all of the federal job training programs, you have to be at a sixth grade level to get into them. If you're not reading at a sixth grade level, that's not for you. If you're not reading at a sixth grade level, you're not prepared for GED classes. So you've got people who aren't even at the point where they can be trained for jobs. And it took a long time for the state and for the city to realize that they had to do something about that. They used to hide it. Now they've embraced it. They changed it from functional illiteracy, and they now call it readiness skills. They got to get people's readiness skills up so that they can get them jobs. You know, our unemployment rate is still at almost 10%, while New York is at 4%, Chicago's at 6%. We're going to stay near double digits until we do something about training people for the jobs that exist and educating people for the jobs that are coming. And it's not going to be on the line doing jobs that are now done by computers.
You also mentioned the last time we spoke that people moving to the suburb, it wasn't a white flight, it was an economic flight, in as that opportunities were moving to the suburbs, so people moved where the jobs were. Are people moving back into the city?
Well, there are lots of people who are moving back into the city, but a lot of those people are young, white, you know, millennials who are excited about the Renaissance.
Okay.
A lot of them are moving into that downtown and midtown area and not in all of the suburbs, in all of the neighborhoods, although there are a few chic neighborhoods that people like, but for the most part, they're moving down there. What you had happen a few years ago was the city of Southfield, which was the sort of, you know, middle-class suburb that many black people lived in as soon as they could, you know, afford a house in the suburbs.
Right.
Well, once it became 55% black, then all of a sudden it was not popular because it was no longer one of the white suburbs. It was a black suburb. So
right.
Then people started moving out from there. You've got people now who live out as far as 50 and 60 miles from downtown and commute in.
Mm-hmm.
It's like living out on Long Island, way out without a train, and coming into, you know, Manhattan.
Right.
So, but you do have a mix of people. You know, there are plenty of folks who, because they want big houses, nice yards, good schools, and good schools is the operative word, that, yes, they're moving regardless of color.
Yeah, I have relatives living in Bloomfield, and I would never would have fathomed in my wildest dream that African-Americans will be living in Bloomfield Hills.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, I have so many friends in Oakland County now, and
exactly.
You know, again, it's about the schools. If you're married and you have children, a lot of these young couples are moving, and they have little kids. But as soon as it's time for school age, then it's like, okay, where are we going?
Mm-hmm.
And they've got to do something about that. And we've got a new superintendent who came in out of Florida and has had some success down there with some turnaround. And he's got to come in and do this. But I wrote an open letter to him in the paper that said, you're not coming just to be superintendent of the schools. You are coming to be a part of the Renaissance team. Because if the schools don't work, nothing else will work. And I just went to a panel discussion of CEOs of major companies at a breakfast just yesterday who said the same thing. If the schools don't work, the Renaissance doesn't work. Detroit is not going to succeed if they don't fix the schools.
Final question, Rochelle. What are some of the other upticks? We know the downtown is thriving. They're rebuilding. People are moving downtown. But is that revolution or renovation happening outward towards 8 Mile?
It's not happening in enough places, but there are some enclaves. There's this great section of town called West Village, just
mm-hmm.
like in New York, that, you know, people have opened shops, they have renovated the buildings, they've got apartments, people are walking and riding bicycles and running with their dogs, and you would not even imagine that you wouldn't have been in Detroit with a scene like that 10 years ago. So that's happening, but there are still too many cities with buildings that are missing and vacant lots, and, you know, just they look horrible, and they want the same type of treatment and the same type of attention that people are getting elsewhere. And that's going to be, you know, really important for this mayor as he faces a reelection battle with Coleman Young Jr., the former Joel Loving, who changed his name and became a state senator, and now that he's term limited and can't do that anymore, he's running for mayor. He's running on the neighborhoods question. It's like, yeah, Mike Duggan gave you downtown and the central city. I'm going to give you the neighborhoods. And some people are interested in that argument.
I understand that you were instrumental in getting the Pistons to move back downtown.
I went to my last Pistons game, and I wrote an open letter to Tom Gores and said, enough is enough. They are the Detroit Pistons. They need to bring their butts back down where they belong. I have no idea whether he read that, but I promise you the conversations happened, and they are now hopefully moving into the arena that's just been built for the hockey team. They're going to share that space, and they're building a practice facility in another neighborhood that's going to help revitalize that neighborhood, and we're going to have all four sports teams downtown.
Rochelle Riley, columnist at the Detroit Free Press. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.